What if Hitler had been killed before he came to power? What if the Axis alliance actually defeated the Allies in World War II? Many have surmised that we would be nothing more than a bunch of German-occupied colonies. What if smartphones had never been invented? Maybe that's just the question that I like to ask. Where would we be as a society? And one of the questions in this kind of pseudoscience field that's asked is, what if Christmas had never happened? Or maybe better asked, what difference does Christmas really make? What's the difference that Christmas actually offers us? Because it's a substantive question. It's a question of, what do we do with the fact that time has been split between B.C., before Christ, and A.D., Anno Domino, in the year of our Lord, or as some like to say, B.C.E., before Common Era, and C.E., Common Era. Either one, the truth is, there's a split in time. What difference does Christmas actually make, and does it really matter? Because there's something about Christ entering into this world as a baby that reset the entire calendar that we utilize. How do we make sense out of that? What difference does Christmas really make? We've been walking our way through this series that we've called Wonder. And we've just been walking through this idea of, how do we recapture, how do we reclaim, how do we reconsider the wonder of Christmas? Because we are so prone to just go through the Christmas holiday caught up in the lights and the music, and all of the wonderful nostalgia. But the truth is, the wonder of Christmas, the reason why we celebrate it in the first place, oftentimes gets missed. What we've been saying is that wonder is defined as a feeling of surprise and amazement caused by something beautiful, remarkable, unexpected, unfamiliar, and inexplicable, unexplainable. How do we reclaim the wonder of what Christmas really does offer us? We've said that reclaiming the wonder of Christmas has the power to reorient our hearts. That our hearts are so prone in the direction of things that don't actually satisfy, don't actually fulfill, and that we're just looking for that next thing that can come somehow give us a euphoric, maybe even an escape moment. But it doesn't ultimately satisfy, that it has the power to reorient our hearts, to rescue our thoughts. So many of us suffer from racing thoughts and things going in a direction, and the anxieties that can produce has the power to rescue our thoughts and help us to reclaim some proper perspective. It also has the power to restructure our motives for why we do what we do in every area of life. What we've said is that on that first Christmas, when those angels came to the shepherds, the lowly shepherds that were out in the field, and they made the proclamation that we bring you good news that will offer great joy for all people, there was something about what they were saying that matters more than I think we recognize. That they were offering something that was indeed bringing good news that was made available to all people, was going to bring great joy, and it was accessible to all people. And yet, the truth is that for many, Christmas isn't good news. For many, Christ isn't good news. For many, this whole idea of the Christian faith isn't good news. And I contend strongly that if the Christian message and the real meaning of Christmas isn't good news for you, it hasn't been presented rightly to you. That you don't really understand the wonder of Christmas if you don't actually see it as good news. But the truth is that the story of Christmas doesn't start on that night where the angels showed up to make that proclamation. The story of Christmas starts 1,500 years earlier from a promise that was made. That the world was in a really dark place, and that God steps into that, and he steps into a moment with an individual by the name of Abram. And he calls Abram out and he says, I want to make you a promise and I'm going to invite you to play a role in my story. And in Genesis 12, we're told this. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. And I will bless you. I will make your name great. And you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. And whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples, we included, by the way, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. That there was a promise that somehow out of Abraham and out of his line, there was going to be a blessing for all people. And we are now here today as a fulfillment of the promise that was made to Abram. But the reason why that night was so special and why that night was proclaimed to be good news that would offer great joy to all people is because in the 1,500 years from the time that promise was made to when that fulfillment was realized that night, there was a whole lot of brokenness and pain and suffering. There was 400 years of slavery by ultimately Abraham's family. There was a ton of occasions where they were simply oppressed by and they were taken captive by and they were brought into exile over and over again. There was this opposition that they faced. And so this question of what is the good news in the face of 1,500 years of waiting? Where is the good news? Where is the promise fulfillment? Where is this whole notion of somehow you're going to be a great nation and through you the entire world is going to be blessed when 1,500 years of waiting is realized? I got to be honest with you. I have a really hard time waiting for 15 minutes. We're all trying to get up and down Alpine right now. And it's a mess. I came home yesterday, I looked at my wife and I said, that's it, I'm done. No more Alpine until after Christmas. And she just said, well, what about Monday? And I said, I know, I'll figure it out by then. I'll grieve between now and then and I'll go do what I have to do. See, this is why one of the things that we have to wrestle with about God is that He doesn't seem to give a flying rip about time. That God's timetable for how things work never fit mine. It's not that sometimes He seems late. Always He seems like He doesn't care about the timetable that I'm trying to set up. In fact, I think there's times where He purposely avoids responding to the timetable that I've established in my head, that how He should respond to the things that I want Him to do. 1,500 years of waiting, 1,500 years, 400 years of slavery, 550, 600 years of captivity, waiting, longing, being handed over from one nation to the next, the Babylonians, to the Persians, to the Greeks, and ultimately to the Romans. Where is this fulfillment? And along the way, there's these prophets that would rise up and they would offer some sort of prophetic word to say, no, don't forget, this promise will be fulfilled. There's one day this good news is going to be realized. Micah in the 8th century BC says this, but you, O Bethlehem Ephraim, are only a small village among all the people of Judah, yet a ruler of Israel, whose origin are in the distant past, will come from you on my behalf. That there's going to be a ruler that comes out of you and that ruler is going to establish a kingdom. And the people are going, we aren't even our own people group right now. We aren't even able to operate the way that we see freely. How do in the world is there going to be a ruler that comes and establishes a new kingdom? Isaiah 9 says this, that the people who walk in darkness, as they all would have been experiencing, will see a great light. For those who live in a land of deep darkness, a light will shine, that there is going to be a light that shines in the midst of this darkness. That's 740 years before the angels show up and say, we bring you good news of great joy for all people. Which means how many generations lived and died waiting for that good news, waiting for that light to shine, and they keep waiting, and they keep waiting, and they keep waiting. And the desperation begins to creep in. Then in the midst of them going into exile, and now they're an occupied people group. And Jeremiah 31, speaking to that group, says that God says, I have loved you with an everlasting love. If you've loved us with an everlasting love, then why are we here doing this? Why are we being occupied by an entire nation? Why are we not able to move freely? How is it that we're supposed to actually trust that you love us? I have continued my faithfulness to you. Really? Faithful? You sure about that? How many times have I asked that question? God, are you still faithful? Are you still who you say you are, and will you do what you have promised to do? You sure about that one? Malachi, just before. So Jeremiah writes just before they go into exile. Malachi writes just before another season where he says, a reminder from the Lord, I have loved you. Recalling back to this promise from Jeremiah, I have loved you. I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have continued to be faithful to you. And you know what happens after Malachi writes that? Everything goes silent. And for 400 years, they now find themselves waiting and wondering. And generation after generation goes by without God ever saying a peep. And they're wondering and they're watching. And God stays silent. How can you love us if you're silent? How can you show your faithfulness to you if you're not showing up for us? We are an occupied nation. We are not a great nation. We don't even have our own ruler. We are simply at the mercy of whatever regime takes us over. And there's silence. And there's waiting. Do you know that we struggle to mistake God's silence for his absence? That we struggle when it feels like God hasn't shown up for a long time to believe that he is who he says he is and will do what he has promised to do. And then something initiated. And years later, after this break into history, after the calendar has been reset, after there's finally been this new word, this good news that's been offered, Paul the Apostle reflects back on this. He says this, but when the set time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law. Paul, reflecting back on Christmas, says, when the set time had finally come. And I can imagine the people going, how is this the right time? How do you not show up 400 years earlier? How do you not show up, I don't know, 1,500 years earlier? How is this the right time? And we've talked before about the fact that there were some unique things that were going on in the background. As God was silent, he was also preparing the stage. How many times have we sat awkwardly as the curtains close and we just wait to see what's now going to show up on the stage for a play that we're watching? And there's this weird awkwardness as we wait and we anticipate. And then the curtains open and there's something brand new on the stage. Well, in that 400 years of silence, some really interesting things happened. That there was a language that became much more uniform. And Koine Greek became kind of the language of the people, where there was a known language that most people could interact with. The Pax Romana, Rome's peaceful pact that was established. You can roam freely in the known world without having to have all of these restrictions. The Pax Romana was established. And what do we know that Rome is known for other than being brutal? Their roads, right? All roads lead to... They're known for their road system. And while that 400 years was going on, there was a language that was being established. There was a peace treaty that was being put in place. And the road system was being established so that the most number of people could have access to the good news that was for all people. That was going to bring great joy. The next time you sit waiting for God to finally speak into your silence, just acknowledge that maybe there's something happening that's beyond your perspective. And maybe he's setting the stage. Because maybe what he's saying is, at the right time, I will. Not my time. Not the way I want. But at the right time, that I will. I love John the Apostle, who was one of Jesus' most beloved friends. In fact, he says of himself that I am the one that Jesus loved. There's no arrogance in that whatsoever. Maybe there is. And he, reflecting on his time with Jesus, says this. The one who is the true light, who gives light to everyone. Remember that promise of the light coming into the world? Was coming into the world. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. He says this Christian idea, this message of Christ is not just some inspirational, philosophical concept. We knew this person, Jesus. We know him. We experienced him. Our hands have touched him, he goes on to say in one of his letters, that we have seen him with our own eyes. We have touched him with our own hands. That this Jesus really did come into the world. Which is why we believe this about the wonder of Christmas, that the incarnation of God in the person of Jesus Christ is a history-altering, paradigm-shattering, life-transforming, literal, true, historical reality. If you're a history buff, look it up. If you're into the experience of what's real, consider the reality of what Christ offers us. If for you it's just about what's true and not true, then it's true. See, the Christian message, the reality of Christ, answers all of the questions. In fact, one of my favorite things about the Christian faith is it invites the critique, it invites the questions, and then it offers answers to the questions. But I said a couple weeks ago that this universe sundering, this splitting into the middle of it, that somehow Christmas sits between B.C. and A.D., that this time frame right here is Christmas. That something happened that changed the world forever. So what's the difference that Christmas makes? Does Christmas actually offer us something that should invoke wonder in our lives? Let me suggest this. That there was a time for the people of Israel as they were waiting for this good news, for the arrival of the Messiah that they longed for, that there was a great deal of confusion. That they sat in a place of incredible confusion. Why has God not shown up? Why are we still waiting? How is it that he's been silent for all of these years? How many generations have gone by waiting, longing for, and not ever seeing a fulfillment of? There was confusion in the midst of that. When Jesus showed up and he walked into this world, and he came as a fragile newborn. And he grew to become a man. And he lived a perfect life and ultimately laid down his life for us. And he said a couple of things along the way. He said, look, I will always be with you. How is that possible? You died. Because I'm going to send one that will abide in you. He said, you are now my friends. And he says, and I will come again. See, the confusion of at this side of B.C. where God shows up and he creates the world and then they exist in this place of before Christ shows up and there's confusion, wondering where God is, what is he doing, why hasn't he shown up yet? Because of Christmas, we now here anticipate the day that because Christ came the first time and promised he would come again, he will come again. Amen. Therefore, we don't sit in a place of confusion. We find ourselves in a place where we are confident. We are confident that the one who came the first time will come a second time. We find ourselves in a place of confusion with this group of people waiting and wondering, and where is he, and why isn't he showing up, and why are we longing the way that we are? And now we find ourselves on the other side of Christmas, confident that he came the first time. We know he'll come again. We know he'll come again. In fact, Paul the Apostle says that the Spirit of God gives us a sense of confidence and sound-mindedness. Why? Because Christ came. What difference does Christmas make? That confusion that has the power to paralyze us, that confusion that allows us to sit in this place of high anxiety, gives way to confidence. Because no matter what the circumstances, no matter how difficult, no matter how silent God may feel, we know he's working because we know he worked the first time. And we know he showed up the first time. What difference does he make? Before Christ came, the people of God, the nation of Israel, were in a place of incredible desperation. They were despairing. They were waiting. They were wondering. One of my favorite images about this time is this picture of Herod's temple. Take a look at it with me. That's the temple that the people would come to, and they would gather and they would worship God. And they were told to do all of these sacrificial things, and they would come and they would share and worshiping and trying to anticipate Yahweh, but they would keep showing up. And in the top right corner, you see something circled. You know what that is? That's a Roman guard shack. That while they were gathering to worship, they would have the occasion where they would regularly come together and they would look up and they would always see the fact that no matter how much we try to maintain the things that God has called us to do, to continue to be faithful to God, that this guard shack seems to indicate that maybe God hasn't been faithful to us. That we are not a chosen people that He is working through to make us into a great nation. We are an occupied people who are desperate for something. We're desperate for a Messiah. And that desperation, that despairing that they found themselves in, was a regular part of their being because they would regularly show up to worship Yahweh and be reminded that seemingly God is not in control. Rome is. And that guard shack was a regular occasion where them looking down, do not do anything to defy Rome because you will lose your life. And Jesus shows up. And they're waiting for Jesus to come, and they're waiting for this Messiah to be present. And then Jesus comes. You know what they do with Jesus? They try to make Him their Messiah, their military leader. They come behind Him and they say, "You are the Messiah. You are the one who speaks with authority. You have these miraculous things that you're able to offer. You've come from God. We are behind you. Let's go." And Jesus says, "No, I'm going to lay down my life." What? "No, I'm going to march in Jerusalem. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to let them kill me." And the disciples going, "That's not what the Messiah is supposed to do." And Jesus says, "Yes, but that's what you need from me. Because there will be a day where I return. And there will be a day that I come in as the conquering warrior. But for today, what you really need is you need me to lay down my life so that I can offer you forgiveness." And so we find ourselves, as much as there may still be confusion on occasion, there may be moments of frustration, that we no longer have the right to despair because now we have hope. And we cling to that hope. And we don't ever have to let that hope go. In fact, I would say this, as much as Christians have the right to be concerned about and have moments of questioning, the one thing we don't get to do is despair. Because even in the midst of our brokenness and our questioning and our angst, we know that our hope does not rest in what happens in this life. And that there is something that takes us past death into something greater. And so we have a hope. We cling to a hope and recognition that because Christ came the first time, because the universe was split in two, and because the calendar was reset, there is a great hope of what the future will offer us. And where He is in the midst of our own lives. I love this one. That there was a time before Christ came where religiosity was just the norm. See, it's interesting that religiosity is that we do religious things just because we want to do religious things. We do religious activities and we participate in these things because we want to earn favor with God. That somehow we want God to approve of us. And so we do religious practices to get His favor. And that's so much of what the Jews understood, is that they're supposed to do these things to earn God's favor. That they're supposed to do these things to get God on their side. And maybe to somehow get the Messiah to show up finally. You know what's awesome? Is on the other side of Christmas, we no longer have religiosity. You know what we have? We have an opportunity for relationship. And it's not just about doing things to get God's approval. See, I love that Jesus says this about religion. He says this in Matthew 5. "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets." All these religious things, don't think that I've come to abolish them, but I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them, to bring them to a culmination, to allow them to finally be seen and understood for what they are, that it's not about religiosity just to do religious things, that it's about something far greater than that. It never really was about that. In fact, over and over again, God condemns the nation of Israel when they're just doing religious things to do religious things or to earn His favor. But we have an opportunity through the person of Jesus to enter into a relationship. That it's not about just religion for the sake of religion, but it's about relationship and intimate connection. And that we have opportunity to have true relationship with Him. I love what John 1 tells us, and as John's reflecting on his time with Jesus, John says, to all who didn't receive Him, to those who believed in His name, He gave the right to become children of God. That we have the right to be the children of God. And then John goes on to tell us that we now have the right to become the friends of Jesus. To have real relationship that really matters. Not just do religious things. Can I be honest with you? A whole lot of Christians do not understand the difference. Because we have not modeled this well. And one of the reasons why the good news of the gospel is not good news for you and maybe for your family and friends is because we've forgotten that it's about relationship and we've turned it back into religiosity. And we've talked about these things that you have to do and you should respond this way and you have to do this or not do this. And we've got camps of people that we disparage and we say horrible things about and we keep coming back to religiosity. Can I tell you, that's just us forgetting that Christ came. That's forgetting the wonder of Christmas. That's just us missing it. And I'm sorry that we miss it so often because we keep gravitating back over here. And in our confusion and in our despairing about this world that we live in, we find ourselves gravitating back towards religiosity. I just want you to know I'm sorry. Because if we truly understand the wonder of Christmas, we understand relationship. And we understand this, that in a relationship with Jesus, we change because of the relationship. We don't do good things to get God's favor. And so we recognize that we're all broken and we're all lost and we're all hurting. And in relationship, we just trust that as Jesus gets into your life, He starts to mess around with some stuff. And there's some things you've been clinging to for a long time where He's like, you know what? I want to deal with that. And I want to give you a better opportunity. And I want to give you the abundant life that I came to offer you. And I promise you, if you'll let go of this, you'll let go of that, I'll start to change your life. And when we talk about it differently, it's because we forget the good news. Because we forget about the relationship. One of the other pieces of this whole conversation is that before Christ, that people had to come to God. That we had to come to God. That we had to earn something from God. That we had to somehow do these religious things to get God's approval. That we had to go up to the temple to participate in these religious things. We had to come to God. Do you know what one of my favorite names for Jesus is? The promise of who Jesus was going to be. We're told that Jesus is Emmanuel. You know what Emmanuel means? God with us. God with us. That we don't have to go to God, that God comes to us. In fact, here's the deal. None of us are here because we went to God. We're all here because God came to us through the person of Jesus, and then He comes to us through the Spirit of God that empowers us to then respond. None of us have believed on our own. We have all been brought into relationship with God because He came to us, to be with us, so that we could be with Him. But we don't have to go to God anymore. He came to be with us. Tim Keller, in his reflection on Christmas, says it this way. If Christmas is true, then we've got a basis for a personal relationship with God. God is no longer a remote idea or a force we cower before, but we can know Him personally. He's become graspable. If Jesus Christ is actually God come in the flesh, you're going to know much more about God. You're seeing Him weep. You're seeing Him upset. You're seeing Him cast down. You're seeing Him exalted. Christmas is an invitation to know Christ personally. Christmas is an invitation by God to say, look what I've done to come near to you. Now draw near to me. I don't want to be a concept. I want to be a friend. What if we understood the meaning of Christmas, the wonder of Christmas, is that we no longer have to gravitate back here. Because I have to be honest with you, if you are interacting with a Christian and you see a Christian who is desperate and simply confused, and you see a Christian who is caught up in religiosity or a Christian who's saying, you have to do these things to get to God, he doesn't understand Christmas. And the reason why the good news for so many people isn't the good news for all people is because we live in BC rather than AD. Because imagine what it's like to live in a place of confidence and relationship with Him because He's come to be with us and have a hope that is undeniable. What if we simply lived here? How would the world look different? Because when Christ came and He entered into the midst of all of this brokenness, He did not come so that we could go back here again. He came to give an abundant life and offer us this. And I promise you this, the good news of Christmas, the good news of great joy for all people, cannot, will not be experienced this way. We have to move in the direction of the fact that Christ did come. And because He came once, we know He's going to come again. And when He comes again, all will be made right. And we anticipate that and we long for that day. And may I simply invite you to consider the wonder of Christmas, because the fact that He came once means that we anticipate the day He will come again. Would the praise team please make their way up here? And as they do, I'm just going to ask you to consider this. Is there any places in your life, is there any places that you would consider that when we ask the question, why are we so prone to live on the BC side of Christmas? The question that I want to ask is, why does Christmas matter to you? How have you encountered, experienced the wonder of Christmas? And is it possible that there are things that we still grapple with, where we find ourselves despairing when we shouldn't be? When we find ourselves hopeless when we shouldn't be? When we find ourselves allowing religiosity to define our reality rather than the relationship that God invites us into and then changes us as a result? May we simply be a people who live out the reality of the wonder of Christmas. And may we never waver in that.